How's everybody doing today? Welcome back to another episode of the Banker Next Door. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Berquist. Today, we're going to be continuing our series of the Lords of Easy Money. We're on part six, and we're going to be covering chapter five today. I really hope everybody is enjoying the series so far, and we're just going to jump right into it here. As once again, I'll bring in my little PowerPoint presentation here as we continue on through. So just a real quick recap of chapter four. So in chapter four, we reviewed the atmosphere at the Fed. We talked about the recession of 1990 and the jobless recovery. We went into Greenspan's public persona, and we talked about Fed speak. We talked about the growing divide between monetary and fiscal policy. We talked about the lasting effects of the New Deal and what ultimately became the Fed's escape hatch. We talked about the Fed's focus on consumer price inflation, which ultimately led to the stock market bubble, which then led to the stock market crash of 2000. We then briefly addressed the terrorist attacks at the end of 2001, and we talked about how the Fed kept basically interest rates low up through 2004. So today's chapter, chapter five, is basically called The Overmighty Citizen, and we're going to cover the years of 2002 to 2010. So we're inching our way a little bit closer to the modern period here, definitely a little closer to today. So we're getting into kind of what happened here over the last 25 years, as opposed to basically the period of kind of like the 1970 to 2000. And so we're going to pick up here. Basically, we're going to start in 2001 and we're going to kind of roll from there. So the first couple of things here, we're going to talk about stoking asset bubbles, and then we're going to talk about too low for too long. So it started in 2001. So Tom was worried that the FOMC might once again be stoking asset bubbles in the Midwest. In March 2001, he cited a specific example, the housing industry. Tom was worried that low rates might push money out on the yield curve and into riskier loans in construction. Banks in our region are beginning to lend more aggressively on real estate, Tom said during that month's FOMC meeting. If rates stayed low, we could see a fairly dramatic shift of funds into that sector as people look to deploy their assets, which might cause some, for lack of a better word, overbuilding in the real estate arena. The dangers of a housing bubble were not some wild theory or unexpected consequence of low rates. They were a predictable danger of cheap debt, because we had seen this before. But it was a danger that Greenspan and others on the FOMC felt was acceptable. Over the next few years, the Federal Reserve stimulated the economy by substituting one asset bubble for another, replacing the stock market bubble with the housing bubble. The theory was that a hot housing market would have spillover effects, which created jobs and encouraged spending and borrowing, and this theory proved to be true. During 2003 and 2004, the real estate business gained steam and the price of housing rose sharply across the country. Just as cheap debt increased farmland prices during the 1970s, low mortgage rates made it easier for people to borrow money and buy a house, increasing competition and pushing prices higher by the year. This dynamic was usually talked about in the same way that inflation in the stock market had been talked about during the late 1990s. It was described as a boom. Houses, like stocks, were described as a key source of middle-class wealth and a vital retirement investment. So the inflation of their value was welcomed as an unalloyed good. And just as in the 1990s, it was only the rising specter of price inflation that forced the Fed to consider raising rates. So here again, you're jumping from one asset bubble to the next. And I could tell you that period of real estate growth was just, I mean, it was unimaginable. I mean, you had every builder, and the market was very different back then than it is today. Like, we'll learn as we get through the financial crisis of 07, 08, 09, and the after effects, the middle builder that was there back in that period does not exist today. You either have what I'd call like the big six builders, your NV Homes, your Toll Brothers, you've got the big boys, and then you got a whole bunch of tiny little, kind of mom and pop smaller builders in the mix. But you don't have those medium sized builders that would come in and, okay, we're going to build 100 townhouses here. We're going to do a 50 home subdivision. You know, those builders just don't exist in the market anymore, but they did back then. And they fueled that just unimaginable growth of these guys. I mean, the housing boom was absolutely incredible. So now we get into too low for too long. So by 2004, Alan Greenspan was worried that rates had been too low for too long. For the first 6 months of 2004, interest rates were essentially flat at 1%. Starting in June, the FOMC began to raise them slowly but steadily, ending the year a little more than 2%. The committee was moving in that direction that he believed was prudent. It was only later, looking back, that Tom realized that the damage was done. The Fed had kept rates at 1% for too long, and when it started raising rates, it raised them so slowly that they were still accommodative, still incentivizing speculation and easy lending. That left an impression on me, Tom recalled. When you keep rates very low, even if they're raising them, but you keep them very low, you are inviting bubbles. Between 2003 and 2007, the average home price in the United States rose by 38% to the highest level ever. Yes, it was incredible. It's hard. You know, I'll have to do another episode where I talk about, and I'm planning to do that, where because the psychology that enveloped people in the moment was quite extraordinary. And I'll have to explain that some separate time in another episode, because I got some good stories to mix in there with that as well. Real world stuff, examples and things like that. So but now. Let's continue on here. Let's move on to my next slide. So Greenspan's exit and Ben Bernanke's entrance. So in 2006, Alan Greenspan retired as chairman of the Federal Reserve, conveniently. He left with a virtually unblemished reputation. He was seen as the engineer of 15 years of nearly unbroken American prosperity. This was the shadow that loomed over his successor, Ben Bernanke. Americans didn't have a strong impression of Bernanke when he took the job. He was soft-spoken, even shy, and didn't generate strong reactions. This was true even among his fellow members on the FOMC, where Bernanke had served since he became a Fed governor in 2002. His tenure at the Fed was interrupted by a brief intermission starting in 2005 when Bernanke was president of the White House's Council of Economic Advisers under George W. Bush. Tom, for one, didn't have much of a sense as to how Bernanke might lead the institution. He didn't know much about the former professor, except that Bernanke was an inflation targeter, meaning that he, like Greenspan, would most likely focus on price inflation rather than asset bubbles. It was, in fact, the fear of price inflation that compelled Bernanke and the FOMC to raise rates sharply in the spring of 2006, pushing the short-term rate to roughly 5%, the highest it had been in years. Funny side note, I was doing a study of interest rates as they were being raised, you know, through 2002 through 2022 into 2023. And I realized that rates, the prime rate, had reached a point that it had not been at since 2006. It had been 17 years. It had been that long since rates had hit that peak. It had gone all the way back to this particular moment in 2006. Right before the financial crisis hit, and that's how long rates stayed below that period, which was pretty incredible when you think about it and you look at the chart. So, in June, Bernanke proposed pushing rates even higher, raising them above 5%. This marks the first time that Tom expressed a serious disagreement with what Bernanke was doing. And the disagreement didn't make much sense to people who thought that Tom was a hard money inflation hawk. Tom believed that the Fed should stop raising rates. Tom said he pointed out that the Fed might be overshooting its target, raising rates so high that they might have more of a disruptive effect on the economy than the Fed intended. So I would hold off. I would be patient and I would be firm in keeping the rate at 5%, Tom said. But you know, the comment ended up invoking some laughter in the room. It wasn't, you know, entirely, you know, Bernanke, you know, didn't really care for it, whatever. So by 2006, Tom had a coherent view of how the Fed should conduct monetary policy, which he had developed over 30 years at the central bank. It would be too simplistic to say that Tom was an inflation hawk, but he also certainly wasn't a dove. If there was single phrase that might capture his philosophy, it was a rule-based approach. This was one that emphasized restraint, incrementalism, and limits on how far the Fed should push its powers. And it had multiple pillars, it had three pillars. The first pillar of the approach was the law of long and variable lags. If there was one thing Tom had learned, it was that the Fed's leaders, who were only human, tended to focus on short-term events and the headlines that surrounded them. But the Fed's actions were expressed in the real world over the long term, after they had time to work their way through the financial system. When there was turmoil in the markets, the Fed leaders wanted to take immediate action to do something. But their actions always played out over months or years and tended to affect the economy in unexpected ways. The second pillar of Tom's view was that the Fed should focus on both of the inflation cousins, asset inflation and price inflation. It was true that detecting out of control asset inflation was more difficult than detecting price inflation. And asset inflation was harder to stop without disrupting markets and making prices fall. But the results of asset inflation were devastating. When asset prices eventually corrected, and they always did, it caused massive financial instability. If the Fed achieved 5% unemployment by encouraging asset inflation, it would have to contend with the 10% unemployment on the other side of the correction. This required the Fed to make ever larger interventions to repair the damage from asset bubbles. In other words, every crisis we've had since the stock market bubble, the real estate collapse, the Great Recession, 07, 08, 09, and then COVID, what do you notice? Every single time the crisis gets bigger and bigger and bigger. First, we're talking about billions. Then we're talking about hundreds of billions. Now we're talking about trillions. So the crisis never gets smaller. It's like Legos building on top. Each crisis builds upon the next. The third and final pillar of Tom's view was that the Fed should show restraint and follow rules that imposed on itself. It should not push interest rates too low too fast, nor hold them there too long. And the Fed should show restraint on the other side of the equation as well. It should not raise interest rates too high too fast, kind of like what they just did. If it was worried about inflation because it might cause a precipitous collapse, the need for restraint was made more important by the law of long and variable lags because it took so long for the Fed's actions to have an effect. Tom believed the FOMC needed to patiently monitor conditions in the real world to measure the effects of what they had already done before doing something more. Keeping their actions within a narrow band helped ensure they didn't overdo it on the upside or the downside of an economic cycle before they even knew how economic actors would react. This kind of restraint had once been imposed on the Fed by the gold standard, but the gold standard was arbitrary and unworkable in its own way. If the gold standard worked, people would still be using it. But without the gold standard, central bank leaders had to figure out how to impose discipline on the money supply. There was really only one solution. They had to replace the typical restraint of the gold supply with the restraining power of their own wisdom and discretion. sorry, didn't mean to laugh there. This view, Tom's view, was the opposite of heroic. It was a model of leadership built on unhappy compromise, focused on results that wouldn't be evident for months or even years. Its unpopularity seemed to be guaranteed. No one wanted to celebrate a Fed official who sought to make the central bank more boring, more limited, or less central to American economic affairs. In other words, you have a lot of pride, narcissism, and hubris at the very center of the Fed and what it does day in and day out, year in and year out. And I think that Ben Bernanke, in certain respects, he absolutely encompassed that. He epitomized that narcissism, that hubris, that pride in all the decisions that he made that we're going to read about in subsequent chapters. And let's talk about the gold standard for a second. There's a note here on the gold standard. So let's read this for a second. The gold supply was influenced by geological factors that had nothing to do with monetary policy, for instance. The discovery of a big new gold mine in Alaska could randomly increase the money supply. This helps explain why the gold standard era was characterized by bank panics, long bouts of deflation, and periodic depressions. Also, for the gold standard to work, nations need to accept punishing bouts of deflation at times, which very few are willing to do. Now, that's also true. But the gold standard was also, it was a restraint. The reason why the gold standard was so powerful and it, you know, and people say, oh, the gold standard didn't work. Gold standard did work, and it did work for a very long time. And the reason why it worked was because it was restraint. It was restraint on the politicians, not the people. It was restraint on the government spending. So that we didn't have this out of control spending. If you literally look at a chart of our debt, and I think I showed this when I did the episode on national debt. If you look at the chart, literally, Nixon takes us off the gold standard in 1971. And if you look at our debt over that period of time from 1971 to today, that debt just explodes because the politicians went nuts because there was nothing to hold them down. So they spent money into oblivion. And that's why we're in the debt crisis that we're in today, because there was nothing there to restrain them. And it's laughable to sit here now and say they had to replace the tyrannical restraint of the gold supply. There was nothing tyrannical about it. And the restraining power using their own wisdom and discretion. Well, anybody who looks at the chart that I show would basically come to the conclusion they had no wisdom. They had no discretion. But anyway, all right, I digress on that. So, okay, so let's get back here. We've gone through Tom's three pillars. Now we're going to talk about Tom at the annual symposium where he makes a big speech here. So, in late October, Tom was invited to give a speech to a group of bank directors at their annual symposium in Tucson, Arizona. This was a regular part of his job. Tom had been interacting with bankers throughout the Midwest since the Fed first hired him in 1973. But the banks he interacted with in 2006 were very different from the banks he dealt with earlier. They were larger, more far-reaching, and more deeply intertwined with one another than ever before. After the banking crisis of the 1980s, Congress relaxed the laws that prohibited banks from doing business in multiple states, hoping to make it easier for the survivors to stay in business. Loosening the interstate banking laws allowed stronger banks to buy up weaker competitors, paving the way for a new breed of giants. So that's a very big thing right there. The interstate banking laws before, you know, in the 1980s, they had, you know, going back before the 1980s, they had interstate banking laws that prevented banks from crossing state lines and coming in and buying other banks. So there were two key things which ultimately led us to too big to fail were the elimination of the interstate banking laws and then the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999. These two legislative laws that had been in place for a long time and had kept the banking system stable for a long time had ultimately, their removal led to massive consolidation in the banking industry and ultimately led truly to too big to fail. And we'll talk about those. And, you could spend, you know, hours and hours and hours just talking about those two laws and the impact and what happened during this period. So we'll save that for another time, but let's kind of continue on with the story here. So what worried Tom as he traveled to Arizona wasn't just the size and the scale of the new banking corporations. It was what they were doing. These bigger banks were making the same kinds of loans that marked the boom years of the late 1970s. Back then, Penn Square made risky oil loans and sold them off as participations. In the mid-2000s, mortgage lenders extended risky home loans and sold them off as mortgage-backed securities. The atmosphere at banking conventions tended to be chummy and exclusive. This was the kind of place that bankers congregate to talk shop and make connections. Tom moved easily through such places and was treated like visiting royalty. His presence at such an event brought prestige and made attendees feel like they had inside access to power. The symposium agenda said that Tom would deliver a speech entitled, "This Time It's Different." This was catnip for a banker. It fed the general sense in 2006 that banking and finance were driven by new and sophisticated insights. This was the age of the quants, meaning analysts who bought and sold stock using software algorithms and the private equity kings who earned billions through buyouts and corporate turnarounds. So asset values are appreciating. Farmland values are strong, and we are all well aware of what has occurred this year with the energy markets. In short, for many in this area of the country, times are good, as Tom began. But then he pointed out that times had also been good back in the early 1980s when asset prices were also rising. But the collapse wiped out 309 banks in the Kansas City Fed District alone. Let me share with you some statements that we actually heard from bankers and bank directors during the 1980s, Tom said. He recalled bankers telling him, if you understood this better, you wouldn't have a problem with it. And yes, we loaned 100% on this project, but everyone knows that the collateral value could only go up during construction. And although this is unconventional, our accountant says it is perfectly legal, and the corporate plane will save money for the bank in the long run. In case the audience missed his point, Tom made it explicit. Age-old behaviors such as greed, short-sightedness, and arrogance are at the center of these problems, and I would caution they are with us today just as they were in the 1980s. Banks might be larger, the financial instruments at their disposal more complex, but at root things were not in fact different in 2006 than they had been before. When asset prices were rising and debt was cheap, it induced reckless behavior. Tom told the story of Penn Square and Continental Illinois and how the reckless behavior of one bank fed into the others. The simple fact is there are times when it is wise not to jump on the bandwagon. In some instances, it is better to let the parade pass you by, Tom said. As directors, you should be extremely cautious if your management can't fully and clearly explain the business lines they are about to enter or if there is too much of a rush to jump in. Tom ended his speech by saying that if things were to end up differently in 2006, it would only be because bank directors, the very people in the audience that night, chose to be more skeptical, more restrained, and more focused on oversight. When I finished, Tom recalled, I got stone silence. He got stone silence. He brought the medicine, and they didn't want the medicine. They didn't like the medicine. They wanted to hear the good times were going to continue to roll, baby. And that's all they wanted to hear. They did not want to hear Tom's hard truths and life lessons. So now we get into Ben Bernanke's congressional testimony. So now we're in March 2007. So Ben Bernanke was invited to testify before the Congressional Joint Economic Committee. He seemed to speak in actual English, even when delivering bad news, and the news wasn't good in 2007. Still, Bernanke assured lawmakers that they didn't need to be overly worried. The slowdown just meant that the economy was transitioning to a more sustainable pace of growth. I feel like I've heard this somewhere before recently. Like, yeah, soft landing. Yeah, don't be worried. There's a soft landing's coming. Don't be worried. It's all good. At this juncture, however, the impact on the broader economy and financial markets of the problems in the subprime market seems likely to be contained, he said. The problems were not contained. For roughly 6 years, the American financial system had arranged itself around the central, nourishing flow of cheap money. When the Fed raised interest rates throughout 2006 and 2007, the effects rippled outward through the economic system and shook it apart. The big tremors began in August 2007 when BNP Paribas, a French banking giant, said it couldn't accurately price some securities based on home loans. This meant that the bank couldn't figure out what the loans were really worth, raising questions about the value of underlying assets that banks depended on for their solvency. Things unraveled relatively quickly after that. The average housing price fell by 10% in a year, a wrenching downward correction for middle-class wealth. By the start of 2009, housing prices had fallen by 20% overall. In two short years, Americans lost about $10 trillion in wealth. $10 trillion in wealth. Remember during the dot-com bubble, I believe it was a little over like $1.79 trillion, and this time it was $10 trillion. The losses were felt at big banks and investment funds, which had been counting mortgage loans as valuable assets on their books. Many faced imminent collapse, just like Continental Illinois when the value of risky energy loans corrected. The stock market crashed in late 2008, when the banking wreckage became obvious, wiping out about $8 trillion in wealth over 2 years. It was the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. The crash of 2008 illuminated the deep disparity that had developed between the power of the Federal Reserve and the power of fiscal authorities like Congress and the White House. The fiscal authorities were exposed as slow and ineffective, while the monetary authority of the Federal Reserve has emerged as robust, keenly maintained, and fast-moving. Now let's talk about enter Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner. Geithner's approach to the crisis embodied the modern Democratic Party's theory of bank regulation. The top priority was to protect the financial stability of banks rather than to close them down or restructure them as FDR had done during the Great Depression. Geithner famously described the strategy as putting foam on the runway. He intended to help the banks make a smooth crash landing and to recover as quickly as possible. The foaming had begun before Obama took office when Congress passed a $700 billion relief package for the banks. To repair the broader damage to the economy, the new administration followed the Keynesian path, spending government money at a moment when the private sector was pulling back. The goal was to stimulate demand and to cushion the downturn, but the effort was hobbled by strong Republican opposition to government spending. A large portion of the resulting stimulus package came in the form of tax cuts. The total package amounted to roughly $787 billion, although later estimates said the true amount added up to $862 billion. This was still not nearly large enough to replace the demand that had been lost. These fiscal programs were dwarfed by the Federal Reserve's actions, the scope and speed of which weren't truly revealed for many years. The Fed had printed and dispersed more than $1 trillion while Congress was still arguing over the language of the stimulus bill. As Bloomberg News and the economic historian Adam Tose later revealed, a lot of this money from the Fed went directly to foreign banks that were in danger of collapse. The Fed opened swap lines with foreign central banks, primarily in Europe, and traded newly created dollars for those banks' foreign currency at a discount rate. The Fed was also active on behalf of banks at home. In late 2008, the Fed engaged for the first time in quantitative easing. It bought about $600 billion in bonds from banks, placing all the new money it created for the purchase directly in their reserve accounts. So let's take a pause for a second here. The Fed had printed and dispersed more than $1 trillion while Congress was still arguing over the language of the stimulus bill. Now, I believe that lending of the Fed would increase to $8 trillion to foreign banks. And I believe, if memory serves me correctly, that this first came out during a congressional hearing when somebody noticed a footnote at the bottom of one of the Fed's financial statements, which basically said, oh yeah, we gave $8 trillion to foreign banks. And that basically was like, wait a minute, when did this happen? And where did this come from? And Ben Bernanke was, pretty mad that he had to answer questions on this and was not happy about it. And furthermore, it never really got, nobody at the Fed was ever held accountable for it. Nobody was ever made to really come forward and explain what they had done and why they had done it, other than to basically say, oh, we were trying to save the economy. We were trying to save the global economy. You know, we had to do it. We had no choice, you know? So the Fed's actions seemed like they were very complicated and sophisticated, an impression that was reinforced when the emergency lending programs were labeled with a wild menagerie of incomprehensible acronyms like TAF, Term Auction Facility, TSLF, Term Securities Lending Facility, and PDCF, Primary Dealer Credit Facility. But this was Fed speak. The Fed's actions amounted to one basic thing. It created new dollars on Wall Street through the accounts of a small club of primary dealers, and it did so at a scale that was unprecedented. It is easiest to grasp the scale of the Fed's actions by comparing them with what the central bank had done over the previous century. Between 1930 and 2008, the Federal Reserve printed more dollars every year at a steady, gradual pace, increasing the supply of new money called the monetary base. Between 1960 and 2007, the Fed increased the monetary base by $788 billion. During the bailouts of 2008, the Fed printed nearly $875 billion. It more than doubled the monetary base in a matter of months. Another way to measure the size of the Fed's interventions is to look at its balance sheet. When the Fed buys something, it takes it onto its balance sheet, which reflects how many dollars the Fed had injected into the banking system. In just a few months after the stock market crash of September, the Fed's balance sheet grew by about $1.35 trillion, more than doubling the assets it already had on its books. And that balance sheet would increase to over $4 trillion before it was done here in this financial crisis. All of this was done with the understanding that these were emergency actions, an extraordinary attempt to confront an extraordinary danger. The financial panic of 2008 threatened to plunge the global economy into a deep depression. The financial system had seized up and banks had ceased doing business with one another because nobody knew who was broke and who wasn't. The Fed stepped in as it had been designed to and short-circuited the panic. But the question for him, for Tom, was what would happen afterward when the emergency passed? This was where the hard decisions would have to be made. So the Fed, they printed more money in a matter of months than they had in their first 100 years. You have to understand that. You have to take that into context. They printed more money in a few months than they had in their first 100 years. And they pumped that money, but did they pump it directly into the money supply? Here's, and we'll get into this, some things to think about. Why did we not see the massive inflation after this money, giant money printing by the Fed? And we'll get into that. I want you to think about that versus, in other words, why did we see the inflation now versus why didn't we see it back then? And we'll get into that. We'll explain all that. But I want you to keep that in your mind as we listen to this. So when the crash of 2008 ended, it was immediately obvious that the danger would be long lasting. Ben Bernanke himself had written the paper explaining how the downturn of 1991 led to a jobless recovery, in part because of an overhang of bad debt. The overhang in 2009 was almost unimaginably larger. This wasn't just a matter of paying off old credit card bills or car loans. Millions of families were evicted, a wrenching process that played out over a decade with 8 million mortgage foreclosures between 2007 and 2016. 8 million mortgage foreclosures. Barack Obama did sign the stimulus bill a month later, but it was the last major fiscal action in response to the crash. Congress turned its energies after that to the passage of the Affordable Care Act and a financial reform bill called the Dodd-Frank Act. So the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, which, you know, destroyed our health insurance. Thank you very much. And the Dodd-Frank Act, which did nothing to fix anything that caused the financial crisis in the first place. The conservative Tea Party movement gathered strength as these measures were debated and helped Republicans take control of the House during the midterm elections of 2010. Paul Tucker, a senior official at the Bank of England, his book was called Unelected Power and discussed the ways in which democratic institutions were increasingly shifting power to non-democratic institutions like the military, the courts, and central banks. The banks were among the last institutions that could act quickly and decisively. This was by design. But the banks were also designed to operate with a narrow focus. The most important constraint is that elected politicians should not be able, in effect, to delegate fiscal policy to the central bank simply because they cannot agree or act themselves. Tucker wrote, he pointed out that doing so creates a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more central banks can do, the less the elected fiscal authority will be incentivized to do, creating a tension with our deepest political values. When this happens, central banks became overmighty citizens, Tucker wrote, capable of imposing sweeping changes on national life. So, you know, here again, the author's bias, again, he's not directly hitting the Tea Party, but it was like, oh, well, you know, this nasty Republican Tea Party came in or whatever. Yeah, well, just be the reason what gave rise to the Tea Party was this right here. The fact that you had the central banks can do more, the more the central banks do, the less the elected fiscal authority will be incentivized to do anything. The Democrats had no incentive to do anything. They just said Obama signed the bill, and that was the last major fiscal action they took. They turned their sights to passing Obamacare and Dodd-Frank and all this other legislation. And that was what Republicans got elected to push back against, you know. And again, I'm not picking on one side or the other. I'm just pointing out that you got to be even-handed in these things. I mean, they're you know, it's a yin and a yang. There's an action and a reaction. That's all. When this happened, central banks became overmighty citizens, Tucker wrote, capable of imposing sweeping changes on national life without the democratic accountability of democratic institutions. In 2010, as Congress effectively ceased to operate, the Federal Reserve took upon itself the job of stoking economic growth, a task that had once been the responsibility of fiscal authorities. If the Fed was an overmighty citizen, then its committee of 12 people on the FOMC faced more pressure with each vote than they cast. So, and now we get to basically Tom's record going into 2010. So in nearly 20 years as an FOMC member, Tom had cast 48 votes. He dissented 4 times in that period, or about 8% of the time. That might sound like a lot of dissent by the standards of a consensus-driven committee, but it meant he still voted with the majority more than 90% of the time. In 2010, it was Tom's turn to rotate back in as a voting member. Tom could sense the uneasiness in the room when he voted against Chairman Bernanke. In 2010, when he voted against the chairman at every single meeting, the uneasiness spilled into almost every corner of his professional life. It's not that you're being lobbied during the FOMC meeting at all. It's just that as you vote no consistently, people kind of look at you as this is very unusual, as even the media is saying it's very unusual. So it's not hard to pick up the tone. But it's a very serious matter, Tom recalled. You really are affecting the economy and therefore the lives of many people, and to be an outlier is not the safest place to be. In 2010, the Fed kept rates at zero and gave forward guidance that assured bankers the rates would stay at zero for a long time, giving them more certainty to make speculative bets. The zero rate incentivized bankers to reach for yield and make risky loans. Once again, the Fed would try to stoke economic growth by stoking asset bubbles and betting that it could clean up the mess if those bubbles collapsed. In August, Ben Bernanke announced the plan to push the Fed's efforts further by pumping $600 billion into the banking system through quantitative easing, even though the economy was starting to grow again. It was true that unemployment was still high, but the economists knew that it would remain high by the end of 2010. The Fed's leadership felt the need to do something about it, to ease conditions as the economy recovered in the hopes that it might speed up the process. It was presented as an insurance policy that could be reversed if needed. So here we kind of get back to where we started at the beginning in chapter one. We kind of started out with Tom at the FOMC, you know, at the meeting with Bernanke dissenting. And so we've kind of made the full circle now. We've covered Tom's early life, his whole career leading up to him becoming Fed president, his experiences throughout the 90s with Alan Greenspan. And now we got to Ben Bernanke. And now we're after at the end of the financial crisis. And now here we are in the aftermath, 2010. And Ben Bernanke wants to go full bore. He's locked interest rates zero and ZERP, the zero interest rate policy. He wants to now go full bore with quantitative easing, just pumping money into the economy to keep it rolling. And Tom is basically sitting there going, no. We've seen this before. We know how this ends. We know how this story ends, and it's not good. And you want to do it on a historic scale, on a scale that nobody has ever seen before. And we cannot even begin to understand how this ultimately will affect the nation, how this will play out. So basically, Ben Bernanke subjected us to a giant science experiment that is still playing out today and will be playing out for many years to come. And we're going to get into that more as we get into the last chapter of the first section of the paper, which is going to be chapter 6, which is going to be the money bomb. And we'll get into that next time. So I hope everybody is enjoying this. I hope you are learning a lot. There's just a tremendous amount of information in this book, which is just absolutely fantastic. So if you're liking these videos, please make sure to like, share, subscribe. That always helps the channel. And I will be back real soon again with some additional videos as we continue on the Lords of Easy Money. So until then, I'll see everybody again soon.